Welcome to Farm to Table Talk, where we talk about our food and how it's grown. I'm your host, Roger Wasson. If we can produce food without soil, why does soil matter? Well, there's no one better to speak up for soil than our guest today, who has a lifetime of work as an advocate for soil health and a pioneer of organic farming. He's a farmer in his farm back in North Dakota. He's a distinguished fellow with the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture at Iowa State University. He's also the president of the board of Stone Barn Center in New York. And he's just widely recognized as a person that understands why soil does matter. And I'm just really delighted to welcome him back to Farm to Table Talk, Fred Kirschenman. Fred, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Fred, you have spoken in favor of Earth and taking care of Mother Earth and your entire career. And yet it just seems like Mother Earth needs defending all the time. you have to keep coming back and saying, well, why does this really matter? And this has come up recently, Fred, because there's been a lot of conversation that you're able to produce food, hydroponics, aquaponics, biponics, whatever you call the ponics, yeah. And you don't necessarily have to have soil. So I think this begs the question that I wanted to bring back to you then, yeah. Is how do we explain that it's soil and what kind of shape the soil and why does that matter?
Yeah. Well, at the heart of that issue for me is the whole issue of reductionism, which has been a part of our culture for a long time. And we still seem to think we can continue to operate that way. That is, basically you want to have the maximum output for the minimum input. And so we kind of have assumed that all we got to do is, if you want to raise food hydroponically, all we got to do is put in the kind of nutrients that the water needs in order to produce the food that we want, and then it's going to be fine. And there are at least two major problems with that. One is that it does not take into consideration the complexity of natural systems. I think that, for me, one of the recent publications that really bring that home to us is David Montgomery and Ann Bickla's book, The Hidden Half of Nature, which really goes into great detail to describe to us the kind of complex microbial community that lives in the soil and that maintains the soil. And then the effect which we have from our food when the food comes from that complex living community in the soil and relates with the complex microbial community in our gut. And then you begin to see those relationships between soil health and human health. So that's one part of it. The other part of it that I think is so important is that we've been able to sustain, quote-unquote, this high-input system for about the last 100 years in our food system. And the reason we've been able to do it is because we've had all of these natural resources which were necessary from which to get those inputs. And if you think about our current food system, it is enormously dependent on a lot of, what Eustace von Liebig, Ernest Chusky called the neocaloric era. That is, it's an era which we've been using old calories, and because they're old calories, they're not renewable. And our whole food system has been dependent on that,
Wait, that is a really unusual way of putting it, old calories. So I suppose they're as old as dinosaurs that have been turned into oil.
Yeah, well, some of them are. The thing is, most of these are calories that have been accumulated in the in the earth, in the soil for thousands and thousands of years. So you have, for example, fossil fuels in our current food system. This high input system is very much dependent on cheap fossil fuels not only for mining them and processing them and, you know, putting them into the soil, but also for, you know, for growing our agricultural products, et cetera. And then there's also things like like rock phosphate, which is the mine which we mine and process into phosphorus. And there are only four countries that still have rock phosphate reserves. And at the rate that we're mining them, one of them being in the United States, the rate that we're mining them, researchers who have looked at this are now telling us that at best we have maybe another 20 years of rock phosphate and maybe not more than another 10 years. So then how do you, so the question then becomes, you know, how do you maintain a high input food production system when you no longer have these inputs? And then you have to add other inputs that most of us don't think about as non-renewable, like water and soil. But, you know, because we haven't paid attention to the biological health of soil, our soil only absorbs about half inch of rainwater an hour, and then it runs off. So then what do we have to do? We have to use our stored water in aquifers, et cetera, for irrigation. So currently we're now using about 70% of our freshwater resources just for agriculture irrigation around the world.
Wow.
And we're drawing down those freshwater resources. Again, if you want to look at where I am here in the Midwest, where the Ogallala Aquifer provides much of the irrigation water for most of agriculture. And again, people who have been looking at the rate that we're withdrawing the water from the Ogallala Aquifer, that there's probably only irrigation water left for maybe, again, another 20 years, maybe not even more than another 10 years.
Now, that's incredible. I mean, it's been there for millions of years, and it's going to be gone in a couple decades.
That's right. That's why we call it a fossil aquifer.
And it actually, that aquifer goes all the way from, what, up in Nebraska and Dakotas, all the way down into some of Arizona even, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's all the way from southern South Dakota all the way down to Texas and Oklahoma, right?
Yeah. We're starting to do more soilless type of productions, and I think that you were pointing out this is almost a continuation of an overall trend. Did you call it a reductionist approach or something like that?
Yeah.
But all of these have us in line to using resources that are somewhat finite, and we're beginning to run out.
There's the two things, that the resources are finite, they're old calories, we're going to run out of them at some point. But the other is also that if you really want to eat food that not only, you know, fills your gut, but that sustains your health, then you have to look at all of the complexity of the living systems of all of those microbial activities that Montgomery and Bickler talk about in their book. And so even if you were able to find all of those non-renewable resources that you could, you know, plug in order to make it grow or make it produce, you still are missing the kind of health-producing capacities that's in good, healthy soil. Now, I'm not trying to say that all soil does that, because, again, if we don't manage our soil for its regenerative capacity so that those microbes can actually, you know, come to life and multiply and produce all of those benefits, then, you know, it's also not doing everything that soil can do. But soil has this capacity. And you know that, you know, most people don't mean, and even, you know, as recently as 15 years ago, even soil scientists would refer to soil as a material to hold a plant in place. Well, fortunately, they're not doing that anymore. And given the beginnings of the direction that we're moving in now, almost all of the literature now is starting to talk about soil health. So, you know, we're beginning to move in the right direction in terms of understanding, you know, the kind of living community that soil actually is. But there is probably up to 1 billion microbes in a single tablespoon of soil.
1 billion microbes. Of course, it seems like we've just discovered the human microbiome in the last few years. I mean, more and more
well, we
now.
We discovered it a long time ago, but we thought it was all the bad guys. So it was the antimicrobial activity that we had to do.
That's right.
And it's only been, like you say, in the last few years that we discover that if you actually encourage through the way we manage living systems, you encourage the microbes to produce, then it's actually the positive microbes that also keep the negative ones in balance, so you don't need the microbes, the antimicrobial activity anymore.
So has anybody done any studies to see what the impact might be on human health
I haven't yet seen some really good peer-reviewed study, but there are individual physicians who have begun to discover this in their own practices. And Daphne Miller, who is a family health professional in the University of California, and she teaches family medicine but also has her own clinic, and she's published a book now called Pharmacology, spelled F-A-R-M, not P-H-I-R, as you might expect from a physician. And she points out that she's now discovered in her own practice that when you put people on a diet of whole food from healthy soil, that does more to sustain their health than any kind of pharmaceuticals that you can come up with. And then there's a second physician, also a woman, who is a practicing physician out in the Bronx. And she's published a book recently called The Dirt Cure. And she goes into great detail, and she runs a clinic for children. And as we all know now, with the kind of, you know, crappy food that we, processed food that we feed children now, the rate of childhood diseases that are diet-related have just been exploding. So she opened a clinic now based on her research and her experience as a practicing physician. And she has found that when you put these children with these diseases, again, on whole food from healthy soil, they start to become healthy in a matter of weeks. And in her book, she goes into great detail about how we've gotten to where we are with our processed food that we give to children, and how now we need to move in this new direction in terms of healthcare, which is, again, grounded in healthy soil, you know, which comes from feeding of the microbial community in the soil.
When you look around the world, are there other countries that are more advanced than we are? Are they all about the same stage of discovering what the role of healthy soil is for healthy food?
That's a really good question, and I don't think that there is, again, any scientific study in other countries that verifies this, but there are certainly experiences that people have had, and in fact, Daphne Miller goes into this to some extent. And in fact, she published an earlier book called The Jungle Effect, in which she discovered, and this was one of the things that led her in this new direction, where she discovered that some people who live in more isolated ecologies that have not been a part of, you know, the modern lifestyle, et cetera, and that they had far less illnesses and many of them longer lifetimes, et cetera. And she began to see that that was connected with, you know, their original culture and the way in which they fed themselves, you know, in their own community. So it was another kind of eye-opening experience for her.
Well, you know, it seems to me that some people listening to us talk about this say, well, that's interesting. And there will be some that say, okay, when they bring me more science, I'll believe it. And then there's going to be others that are going to say, well, that seems plausible. What do we get to lose? I think I should try to eat food from healthy soils. But how do you do that? I mean, how does the consumer that says, okay, fine, I buy that. I think that makes sense. I hope people take care of soil health. But how do you find food that's been produced from the healthiest soils?
Yeah, that's a really good question because, you know, a lot of people who are enamored with organic agriculture would probably say, well, you just get organic, food. But the fact is that, unfortunately, you can become a farmer that doesn't engage in the kind of diversity, et cetera, that's needed to feed the microbial community, and you can get certified organic. So you can be a monoculture strawberry grower, which only grows strawberries and simply uses natural inputs instead of synthetic inputs in order to get the kind of production that you want, and then you don't get that. The benefit from so for the most part, what enables people to at least begin to move in this kind of direction is when they start to connect with a CSA or farmers market, where they actually get to know the farmers and they can talk with the farmers and find out whether farmers are actually producing that food based on, you know, practices which restore the health of the soil. And that's not too hard to find out. I mean, you don't have to have real in-depth conversations. You just, you know, ask the farmers, you know, well, how did you grow these tomatoes? And then based on the answers that you get, you can pretty much tell whether they're doing this with a system that restores the health of the soil, or if they're, using some kind of natural inputs.
So Fred, I wonder if some of these large corporations that are buying from larger farms of vegetables and so forth, I wonder if they'll try to promote and incorporate soil building into the system so they can tell that story. I mean, if enough people want to hear this story about how it's done and know that, maybe that's something that they'll be marketing in the future, by wishful thinking, perhaps.
Yeah, that's another great observation. And some of the good news that I've been seeing, at least now, is that we do have some major food companies, and General Mills being one of them. I simply know that because General Mills purchased Annie's a number of years ago, and the vice president of Annie's called me a couple of months ago, and she said, I want to talk to you because what the managers of General Mills have now asked me to do is they want me to figure out how they can find food from farmers that have produced food from healthy soil, because that's the future of the food system. So when you have companies like General Mills doing that, and they're not the only ones, there are other companies that are, seeing this as well, Unilever, for example, et cetera. So there's a beginning awareness, and part of that is because, and I don't want to romanticize the millennial generation, but there is in my experience at least, there's the beginnings of a transformation that's taking place in our culture, because people in the millennial generation now are no longer so interested in, just what's, the kind of mine and now culture that Paul Roberts talked about. That emerged in our culture since the 1960s, and that's now becoming dysfunctional, and they see that. And so they are now trying to move into a future where we do this things for the common good. And when you make that transition in your spiritual center, you begin to, look more for the kind of food that comes from the kind of things that we've been talking about. And so companies are starting to recognize that. And if they want to be successful very far into the future, they have to pay attention to this.
Well, those people that care, like the millennials that you mentioned, they may feel that you burst their bubble when something you said a few minutes ago, that they assume that just because it's certified organic, that certain kind of soil building activities are taking place. When you pointed out that isn't necessarily the case, why isn't that the case? I mean, we have rules and regulations on what can be certified organic. Isn't there something in it about trying to improve the soil?
Well, from my perspective, the reason that we've gotten to that point, and I was part of the organic board when we were developing the rules to implement the organic law. This was back in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. The board was wrestling with these rules, and there were several of us on the board that were concerned about the very thing that we're talking about, and trying to make sure that we're going to move in a direction where organic is based on healthy soils, et cetera. And so we actually talked the board into including health of soil as part of the requirement to be certified organic, and that you had to, if you were going to get certified as a farmer, you had to be able to demonstrate that at least your soil was not getting less healthy over a period of time, and preferably getting more healthy. And so they agreed on that. And I didn't know this at the time, but what I learned then was that if you develop a regulation within USDA, it has to go through the legal team to be approved by the legal team as being, enforceable legally. And when they got this recommendation, they threw it out. They said, in order for a regulation to be acceptable and to be enforceable, you have to be able to answer it with a yes or a no. And so that's how we ended up with you can get certified organic if you don't use any synthetic inputs except those that are on the approved list. That's a yes or a no. And as long as you only use natural inputs except those on the unapproved list, that's a yes or a no. And so that's how we ended up with where we are. So you can use, you can get certified organic, as I said, simply by using natural inputs that are on the approved list, and then and you don't have to pay attention to soil health.
Because you see some contradictory information from time to time.
And again, on the good news side here, and I'm not involved with USDA on all of this anymore, so I'm not. I don't have direct information, but what I see from what I read is that there is beginning now to be at least some conversations around the importance of soil health. And you know, I don't think that organic can ignore that in the future when actually, you know, soil health is being, you know, considered by General Mills and companies like that. You know, if you want organic to be have any relevance in the marketplace, then they have to begin to deal with it.
I just saw a story about some farmers that have been paying a lot of attention to their organic production and building up the soil health, and they're worried about the hydroponic farming that's coming in, and sometimes it could be a very industrialized type of production system that's really large with hundreds of acres, maybe under glass. And it would qualify for certified organic because it's not using synthetic fertilizers and pesticides. And so the area that's of the biggest concern probably to most consumers, those are true, but they have nothing to do with soil. And so some of these small farmers are feeling that if there's not a differentiation made, they fear like they're going to be put out of business because of these large greenhouses that are able to sell a certified organic, and the consumer won't know the difference. Is that a fair...
it is, absolutely. That's exactly what's going on. And this is purely speculation on my part, but, you know, one of the things that's been happening just in the last couple of years is increasing demand and development of biodynamic agriculture. Mm-hmm. And this is my speculation. I think the primary reason that that's happening is because there are customers who exactly want what you just described, you know, to be able to identify those organic farmers who are doing they're managing their farms in terms of soil health, et cetera. The biodynamic, which is really a form of organic in a way, but in order to get certified biodynamic, you have to, there are the requirement. You can't just use natural inputs. I mean, you have to have diversity in the system and all of the things that are necessary for, you know, the kind of soil health development. And so I think that's what's, again, that's a market-driven thing. And so I think we're likely to see, the biodynamic agriculture, the food system emerge more.
It seems like it's going to confuse people. You know, I can understand the way you just described getting to that point where people would feel like this is something I have to go to the market and kind of explain this because it's emphasizing soil health and what otherwise would be qualified as organic. But imagine the poor consumer that's trying to sort things right now and know that natural doesn't really mean anything, and here there's non-GMO and there's organic and hydroponic and biodynamic, and I could see them standing there at their shopping cart and scratching their head.
And it's, you know, and any time you have these kinds of transitional things taking place in society, you know, you have that kind of confusion for a period of time. You know, biodynamic wines are really, for the most part, excellent tasting wines. And a lot of times when I go to these food fairs and I see people standing around the booths with the biodynamic wine and saying, wow, this is such good wine, you know, what this is. And so the term biodynamic begins to make sense to them in terms of certain kinds of qualities of things. And So how this is all going to play out, I don't know. But in terms of, if you look at this in terms of the longer term issue, as we deplete these resources that we've been depending on for our input intensive system are no longer going to be there, and the costs continue to go up, and there is increasing concerns about health of especially children, I think, you know, we could see these kinds of transformations take place fairly quickly. And again, from my perspective, when you start to have major food companies, you know, like Unilever and General Mills, et cetera, you know, they're going to do their own marketing of this. And so I think that, you know, if there's going to continue to be confusion, you know, probably for another 5 to 10 years in the marketplace, but eventually it's going to get clarified in ways because the marketing systems are going to need to respond to the demands of consumers who want some clarity around these issues.
Well, if we get back to the soil, that's going to be where all this starts, obviously.
Right.
Soils are so different. You know, if you go from the Atlantic to the Pacific, you know, we've got where you are now, some deep black soils right in that area, and then you go further south, and it gets lighter colored and more timber soils, and, you know, you get through the deserts and everything. So every part of the country probably has to have, you know, a different approach to how they have to treat their soils, don't they?
Yeah, and this brings up another issue. You know, we've gotten so used to in our industrial culture that we can produce one kind of seed and sell it to farmers anywhere in the world, or we can get food from wherever we want or sell it to wherever we want, and it's this whole kind of global uniformity that we've been, because that's the most efficient from a strictly economic point of view. But we're already, and here's another resource, I don't want to just keep throwing books at you, but John Takara published a new book, and the title of his book is How to Thrive in the Next Economy. And John Takara is an interesting individual, published an interesting book back in 2006 called In the Bubble, which was about the Internet, and he had a different perspective around the Internet, and he was exactly right about that. But what he discovered and what he pointed out in the hidden half of nature is that there's a new economy that's developing now, and he discovered this based on his travels around the world. And what he claims is already happening, and much more in the developing world and in the developed world, but to some extent even happening in the developed world, and that is that people are beginning to recognize that this global economy just doesn't function for them anymore, because they're much more dependent on the ecological resources of their own regions. And so they begin to look at their own biological region and begin to ask themselves, how do we thrive? How do we create an economy that we can thrive in our own region? And then they begin to come together and they look at their ecological resources and they figure out how to use those resources in a way that they get regenerated in the process of using them. And then food and agriculture, of course, becomes a critical part of that. And he claims that he calls them bioregionalisms. These bioregionalisms are already happening out there. And then he makes this interesting point. He said for all of these bioregions, there's a similar kind of transformation, and it's regard to how people think about growth. Growth is no longer about unlimited economic growth. Growth now is about regenerating life on Earth, and that becomes the primary focus of the way that they can flourish and thrive in their own regions. And so, I think that we're going to see that as these resources that we've been dependent on for, you know, this century-long economy based on all of these inputs, these input-intensive approaches, and as that begins to become dysfunctional, I think you're going to see more and more people beginning to look at these bioregions. And again, as an interesting thing, right here in the Midwest, there is an area called the Driftless Region, which is a little bit of the corner of Iowa and some parts of Minnesota and Wisconsin and a little bit of Illinois. And this Driftless Region is a absolutely rural economy. There's a new study that's come out now in which apparently there are people that are beginning to say, wait a minute, you know, we just produce, you know, some corn and beans and we ship them out and we are so totally dependent on other people to feed us. Why don't we start growing some of our own food? And so there's now the beginnings of a movement to transform that whole Driftless Region by people that are living in that region, looking at how they can have a much more thriving kind of region with, looking at how they can vitalize their own you know, their own area for their own people.
You know, I hope somebody that's listening to this maybe has something to share that they're doing in their own regions, because I hear of this from time to time. And you see different areas. And the thing that also strikes me about it, Fred, is that they all are kind of doing whatever works for them. I mean, it's not like somebody has sent out a master plan from Washington and said, let's all do this. They're finding what is the strength of their region, and then finding links between the farmers and the restaurants and the schools and so forth. And it's getting new people into the businesses, too.
Well, and this is why I say I think that Takara is right, that it's starting to happen to some extent also in the developed world. And again, one of the, in fact, he mentions this in his book, is the food commons movement in the Fresno, California area, which is also where, you know, this is not just about, you know, people in the city asking farmers to do things differently. The farmers and the people in the city are, you know, developing a common bond and working at all of this together to have a kind of food system that provides the kind of quality of food that people want, that then, you know, made available in an affordable way. And that's been going on for, 10 or 15 years now. And then also this driftless reason, if you're interested, again, there is Robert Wolf, who's a writer, and he has written a little book about all of this now called Building the Agricultural City, a Handbook for Rural Renewal. And he goes into great detail about how this is happening in the Driftless region. So it's, you know, it's nice to see the arts get involved in terms of, you know, telling the stories of these things, and I think that can help to move things forward.
I tell you what, Fred, it's always great to talk to you because you're excited about it. I mean, you sound like you're just now are coming out of college and ready to hit it, and in fact, you've spent decades in this, and it doesn't sound like your enthusiasm is any less at all. You seem to be pretty excited about it, and that's kind of my final question for you. I want you to kind of revisit these enthusiasms that we've been talking about, and tell me over these next 4 or 5 years, what is it that gives you the most hope, the most reason to be enthusiastic about what's going on with food system?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, of course, it's very easy to, you know, to become, you know, terribly discouraged and even pessimistic if you look at, you know, the downsides of things. But, you know, I always try, it seems to me based, and I don't know, this may just be my own life's experience, but I have always found that when there are things that are going to, that are not going to work well, that are going to be bad for you, that always gets to a point where, you know, enough people realize that this is not the way we ought to do this anymore, and then there becomes the incentives for innovative kinds of things and doing new things. And I think that, you know, there's, you know, there's a lot of things that we often look at as being terrible and bad for us, but on the one of the things is they also become the motivators for bringing about changing and doing things differently. This is why, you know, I like John Takara's way of you know, how to thrive in the next economy. So it's really about flourishing and having a more flourishing life. And I don't talk to hardly anybody now that is you know, totally focused on a flourishing life. Most of us are focused on, you know, the kind of bad things that are happening, and that's understandable. But I think there's also grounds, if you really look, you know, behind the scenes a little bit, that that we're going to have a lot of opportunities for significant changes in our future.
Well, that's exciting. And I think, Fred Kirschman, you live a flourishing life, and you're affecting a lot of us, that providing inspiration to see both a bright side and a realistic way that we're moving forward with our food system. And I just want to thank you for being a friend and for talking to us today on Farm to Table Talk.
It's my pleasure.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on SoundCloud, Facebook, and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.